This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Emerald Data Solutions, whose Board Docs web applications are designed to help governing bodies operate more effectively by eliminating paper and streamlining board packet processes. BoardDocs.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Alibaba, 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 the Fed, and Scotland. Also, on a Friday, the latest in office dress codes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. Learn more at Moo.com. And by MailChimp. More than 6 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, everybody. This one is the 19th of September. Great, as always, to have you with us. Big week in the world of business and the economy. The Fed voted. Janet Yellen spoke. Alibaba, as you might have heard, went public. So let us get going. Here to help us unpack the 5 days gone by are John Carney from The Wall Street Journal and Jolene Kent from Fox Business. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Good morning. Oh, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I know. Well, you've been working all day, right, Joe? Because this was a big day on the stock exchange. Alibaba went public, as we know. Tell me what it means in the big picture.
Well, it essentially means that we have a big new company to invest in as Americans. And this is the most important company in China right now, Kai. This company dominates more than 80% of the e-commerce market. But I actually interviewed Jack Ma this morning. And you know, this company is not just any company. They're registered in the Cayman Islands. They are a Chinese company that is influenced by the Chinese government. So I said, you know, why should investors not be worried? It's not a typical structure. And he said, it's all about building trust. That was his answer.
I love that.
And he said, yeah, that's what it was.
Exactly. It's all trust. So, John, if you had $92 and some odd cents, would you buy a share of Alibaba today?
Oh, no way. I
would go near Alibaba. What part scared you off, the Chinese government or the Cayman Islands?
You know, the structure is very complicated. There's also this other company that Jack Ma partly owns that is the biggest, that provides all the services, payment services. I don't understand how all these parts fit together. And one thing, a general rule, I think investors should be wary of companies they don't really understand how they all fit together.
Yeah. So this is a real company, Joe. It's got actual profits. So it's not like it was back in the boom where we, you know, where Pets.com went public on nothing. But is this another notch in the, ooh, this is kind of a tech bubble belt?
I don't think so, at least not Alibaba. It's a company that has revenue that's 125% of eBay and Amazon. You know, they actually do a very robust business. Yeah. Nobody shops at malls in China. They don't have that culture. They shop online, and they shop on Alibaba platforms.
And they do a lot of it. All right. John Carney, moving on. Janet Yellen, the Federal Reserve, they voted this week, obviously, not to raise interest rates. There was much conversation about that period of time thing, the considerable time until the Fed does raise interest rates. She spent a lot of her press conference not telling us what that meant. We can basically expect rates to go up sometime next year, yeah?
Right. Everybody thinks that it means about 6 months. The most interesting thing I thought was in the forecast, so meaning that all the economists at the Fed get together and they say, like, where do we think rates will be at the end of 2015?
Right.
And they actually said those would be higher than they did last June. So even though they didn't move necessarily up forward the date that they were going to start raising rates, it looks like they expect that they'll raise rates more quickly than they thought they were going to a while ago.
All right. So, Joe, this is a complete hypothetical. So I guess sort of you can answer any way you want. But what happens that first day when the Fed raises rates? Does the world explode or do we all kind of go, yeah, this was coming, so let's deal?
Some of the analysts I've talked to say that, you know, we've expected this for so long.
Yeah.
So the market is going to be preparing for it. But certainly there's been a lot of reliance on these very low rates to keep the economy growing in a sense. So it could go either way, I suppose.
John, let's talk about America and the global economy for a second. We had the Scotland vote, the no vote last night, and we're going to be talking to a BBCer here in a little bit. Where are you on the whole Europe is slowing down, China's slowing down, and it's a little bit of a mess out there question?
I think Europe is actually coming out of the slowdown. I think I think they're getting better. I think China is actually still in danger of slowing down even further. We've seen that the Chinese central bank is trying to provide more liquidity to jumpstart their economy a little more. We know from our own experience that doesn't always work so well. So I think there may be some more headwinds in China and more tailwinds in Europe.
Joe, talk to me for a second about China. You've lived over there. You've worked over there, as have I. What's your sense of how they are feeling about their own domestic economy? Because, as you know, it's been all about generating domestic Chinese demand for a number of years now.
Yeah, because domestic Chinese demand for the Communist Party means stability.
Right.
And that is the number one priority. You definitely see this GDP growth slow down and the president is trying to deal with it. That number means a lot, even though it's probably not the most accurate number to measure the Chinese economy, right? But for the domestic consumer, it does mean a lot. So we'll have to see what happens. But going back to Alibaba, you know, we're watching those revenues.
Exactly.
And if the middle class is going to not consume as much, this company will definitely impact American investors, and then you have a global impact there, for sure.
Well, that's one of the greatest things about Alibaba. For years, people who were very bullish on China or very skeptical on China had no great way of directly playing the Chinese economy. Alibaba gives it to you. So if you want to short China, you've got Alibaba there right for you.
$92
that's
and
true,
some
but
odd
that's...
cents today is what it was. All right, we got a boogie. Enough about
all
China
right.
and the global economy. We'll talk next time you guys are on. Joel and Ken from Fox Business and John Carney from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you guys.
Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. A correction now before we go on. We got it wrong yesterday in our history of inflation. We said Paul Volcker started raising interest rates in the Reagan administration. It was, in fact, Jimmy Carter who appointed Volcker to chair the Fed and raise interest rates. And as it happens, I asked President Carter about exactly that a couple of years ago. Here's that exchange. On the topic of Paul Volcker, if I could just back up for a second.
Yeah, please.
You put him in the job.
Yes.
You, in essence, made this deal with him where he would do what he had to do and you would suffer the political consequences, according to your telling of it. And yet, it seems to me that he is most remembered and the president he is most associated with is Ronald Reagan for breaking the back of inflation. Does that gall you at all?
Not gall me, but you know, I recognize
it. Bug you
fact.
A little bit?
Well, you know, I was the one that suffered politically, and Ronald Reagan was the one that benefited from the Paul Volcker economic philosophy. But I don't begrudge the fact that it happened during the next term. I thought the next term was going to be mine.
Oh, well, huh? A little wistful laugh from the former president there. On Wall Street today, a bit more mixed than one might have imagined. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The actual price on Alibaba was $93.89 a share, now that I've pulled it up on my computer screen. As Joel and Kent was telling us back in their app, that company's founder is an interesting, interesting guy. Jack Ma is his name. We asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill to tell us a little more about him.
There's no two ways about it. Jack Ma is a quirky guy. From dressing up like Lady Gaga to belting the Lion King theme song.
Okay.
To revealing on CNBC that his hero is the decidedly fictional Forrest Gump.
I watched the movie again and telling me that no matter whatever changed, you are you.
Jack Ma is Jack Ma. And Jack Ma is not the buttoned-up or turtlenecked-up CEO that we're accustomed to. But don't let it fool you.
Everyone seems to underestimate Jack Ma.
Porter Arisman is a former VP at Alibaba and director of the documentary Crocodile in the Yangtze.
When people look at Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs, I think you could say the same things about Jack Ma. He's incredibly innovative, very visionary with a long-term vision.
Ma is also ambitious. Max Wolf is an economist at Manhattan Venture Partners, which helped institutional investors get a hold of shares. He says Ma might have to tone it down a bit now that he wants to extend Alibaba's reach far beyond China.
The particular kind of quirky flamboyance that he has historically displayed, it probably sells, seems to sell very, very well there. It won't sell quite as well for a global audience.
But so far, Ma's flash doesn't seem to be scaring off investors, even though the company's set up in such a way that Ma will be in control, not shareholders. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
With the question of Scottish independence firmly settled, 55% nay, 45% aye last night, if you missed it, we can now move on to the next question, which is, what happens now? The BBC's Lucy Burton is in Glasgow. Lucy, it's good to have you with us.
Lovely to be here, Kai.
First things first, I suppose, what's the mood? I guess you have half the people happy and half the people not happy.
Well, that's exactly right. And as you know, both sides here have been campaigning passionately. But in the end, it was the silent majority who won. And so this morning, there is a really strange atmosphere here in Glasgow because the very vocal yes campaign are now very quiet, very despondent, some of them very angry, actually. We had a few run-ins with very angry yes voters.
Yeah.
And the no voters feel relieved. They're not gloating. They just feel relieved.
How much of the vote do you suppose was economically driven, whether it was getting to keep the pound or what happens to the oil off the coast or, the Royal Bank of Scotland saying it was going to reincorporate in London? How much was that a factor, do you think?
I think it was a real mix, Kai. For the no voters, it certainly perhaps played a bigger part. Lots of the no voters I spoke to said that actually they were convinced by the arguments made by businesses saying that they may have to move their bases from Scotland down to London. They were worried about their jobs. We went actually to BAE Systems. They've got a big shipbuilding factory on the side of the Clyde, and a lot of their workers voted no because they were worried about their jobs. On the other side, you had the yes voters who thought that a lot of these economic issues were really, it's a case of scaremongering, really, by the Better Together campaign. And they felt that they hadn't been given perhaps just all of the, they didn't really have all the knowledge. And of course, one side are very passionately saying that there would be a currency union, and the other side were very passionately saying that there wasn't. So in the end, it just came down to a case of who do you trust? And what, for a lot of people, it came down to what does your heart tell you?
Much has been made of the promised devolution of power from Westminster, from London and the British Parliament and the government there to Scotland. And now Prime Minister Cameron said this morning to Wales and other parts of the UK. How serious do people believe that actually is, and will it happen?
Again, with everything here, there's a mix. People who have voted no, many of them voted no because they really believed that these powers had been promised. David Cameron has promised that this transfer of power will happen, and they are very enthusiastic about this. But then again, on the other side of the camp, the yes votes say that isn't enough. We can't still have Westminster deciding things like defence policy, foreign policy, and they still want to have all the power here up in Scotland.
Lucy Burton with the BBC in Glasgow, Scotland. Lucy, thanks so much.
Lovely to be with you, Kai.
Coming up,
if you order such a huge amount of restitution to a young person who has no ability to pay it, How meaningful is that as a consequence?
Juvenile justice and a teenager's wallet. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 13 points on this Friday, almost a 10%, closed at 17,279. The NASDAQ was off 13 points, 0.3%, 45.79 there. The S&P 500 down just a tad, 2010. For the week, the Dow up 1.7%. The NASDAQ gave back 0.3%. The S&P 500 up 1.3%. Alibaba, we told you about. Yahoo, which owns about a quarter of Alibaba shares, reportedly sold off 121 million of them today. Yahoo shares themselves, fell 2.75%. Tech company Oracle dropped 4.2% today. It announced yesterday that founder Larry Ellison is stepping down as CEO after 37 years. He remains, however, the company's biggest shareholder going away. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.57%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Rice University's Jones Graduate School of Business, committed to transforming business thought through innovation, scholarship, and research. Learn more at business.rice.edu. By Nuance Power PDF, designed to easily and accurately convert, edit, combine, and collaborate on business documents. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised. And by Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos all available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. Want to tell your story? Be part of our listener-generated series, I've Always Wondered, featuring questions from you about the economy. Submit your story and check out the ones we've already done at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors releases existing home sales for the month of August. Do you feel that chill in the air? It's time to store away your flip-flops and swimsuits. It's the last day of summer. On this day in 1994, the TV sitcom Friends premiered on NBC. The show aired for 10 seasons. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I've been traveling quite a bit lately, which means I've been spending a lot of time with Concur, the system that Marketplace uses to itemize expenses when we're out on the road. Cab rides, random cups of coffee, minibar expenses. No, accounting, I'm kidding. I don't expense that. At least I don't call it minibar expenses. Anyway, this week the software giant SAP scooped up Concur for a little north of $8 billion. $8 billion for a company that tracks travel expenses because why? Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has the answer.
SAP has been successful selling software to help the world's biggest companies run their operations. The challenge, says Forrester Research analyst Ted Shadler, is that the software industry is changing, and SAP has an obvious hole.
They've been missing this big transition, which is to the move to what they call cloud services.
SAP has installed software at the office, but the new and cheaper way to run software is through these cloud services, where businesses pay to have the software run for them. Shadler says buying Concur is a signal to SAP's clients that it's taking a giant step into the cloud.
With a cloud, it's very easy to add new customers quickly. It's a lot easier to improve the cloud software.
For all the potential, analysts are mixed on SAP's purchase. Morningstar's Rick Summer says Concur does little to meet the needs of SAP's core customers.
Simply by going out and buying Concur, SAP can't walk in and say, hey, look, we can make your inventory management system ready for the cloud tomorrow.
But Summer says he does believe for $8 billion, SAP has bought itself some time.
The companies that really have great, strong relationships with their customers can be patient and really over years and perhaps even over a decade move their customers over to that public cloud.
Summer says it's difficult and expensive for SAP's customers to rip out their software and plug into the cloud with a competitor. But he adds, to remain an industry leader, the software giant must clarify its cloud picture soon. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We remarked a number of weeks ago, or maybe it was longer ago than that, I don't really remember, about the rise of the short suit, the increasing popularity of a suit with shorts instead of pants. Well, I do believe we can top that today. The Suitsie is a cross between a business suit and a onesie, like babies wear. It's from the San Francisco designer Jesse Herzog, and it is what it sounds like, a onesie that looks just like a suit, complete with fake buttons and cuffs sticking out of the jacket sleeves and a belt, too. The idea is for you to look professional enough to meet a workplace dress code, but somehow feel like you're wearing pajamas. As Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, the office dress code simply is not what it once was.
I have a small confession here. Marketplace is the first place I have ever worked where I did not cause a dress code to be implemented. Memo Lyons is my former boss.
And I can remember those hideous brown pants. And there were those horrible shoes that I tried to throw out once.
Luckily, for some of us, dress codes have changed a lot.
Oh, yes. I mean, if we think back over the last 20 to 30 years, I mean, men came to work in suit and tie, women in jackets and skirts.
Marsha Rubin chairs the Department of Management at Golden Gate University's Graduate School of Business.
It's really evolved to much more casual. I've been at some companies where people come to work in sweatsuits.
Traditionally, dress codes were used to separate work from home, role from individual.
One of the things that you find is a trend towards trying to blur this boundary more.
Jeffrey Sanchez-Burks is at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
Part of it's a generational shift. Part of it's a cultural shift.
This hasn't happened across all industries equally. The tech industry is much more casual compared to banks and finance, where you need the suit and tie, or doctors who need the white coat.
There are certain types of industries where society would prefer there to be less change.
Take banks and doctors. Creative accounting, experimental medicine, not selling points. A traditional dress code says stability. But in the tech industry, creativity and change are the selling points. And the casual or unorthodox dress code reflects that.
You're signaling a break from tradition.
Luckily for radio reporters, nobody can see what you're wearing. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We've been working with Youth Radio on a series about money and the juvenile justice system. It's called Double Charged. Today, a story about restitution, the process by which victims of crimes can be reimbursed for their losses. Exactly how that process works, though, and the amount of money involved varies by state, as does the ability of juvenile offenders to pay. Youth Radio's Sarah Quevedo has the story.
This is that right there. This is a little burn mark on the floor.
Ricky Brum is standing with one of my producers behind a furniture store in Manteca, California. And to be honest, it's a little awkward. He doesn't really want to be here. Last February, Brum set some cardboard boxes on fire in this alleyway.
So how many boxes would you say? About like four or five?
No, it was filled with boxes. Probably like seven littler boxes instead of a big box. Like, I just sat there and I was like, bam.
That bam changed Ricky Brum's life. He was 15 when he set the fire, and it was his first time getting in trouble with the law. He was lucky. His charges were reduced to a misdemeanor. He went on probation and served no time in juvenile hall. Brum and his mom, Leanne, thought the worst was behind them. But then, while meeting with their public defender, they found out about restitution.
They gave us this big packet of paper, and we
thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
And she said, no, it's not a joke. I said, really? They can do this? She said, well, they can ask.
Sitting at his kitchen table, Ricky Brum flips through the restitution claim. It's got nearly 1,400 items. Even though the fire department's report says there was no damage to anything in the furniture store, the owner claimed his entire inventory was smoke damaged.
All right, we got a table lamp, $149, sectional sofa, $2,000.
Brum's family is fortunate. They own a house and have homeowner's insurance. And the insurance company went to bat for them, negotiating the restitution down to $10,000, which their insurance paid for. Christine Kroger, Ricky Brum's attorney, says the bill was originally $221,000.
Which is impossible for a kid to pay.
Some states limit restitution for juveniles, but in California, there are no limits to how much money minors can owe victims, often on top of serving time behind bars.
A lot of people give lip service to rehabilitation of the minor. But what we see is it's all about punishment. For example, there's a whole caseload of kids who have satisfied every other term and condition of their probation, but they just don't get off probation because they still owe money.
Restitution can't be erased by claiming bankruptcy, and if it still exists by the time offenders turn 21, it can turn into a civil judgment. Victims can garnish up to 25% of offenders' wages, can take their tax refunds, and place liens on property.
So they were out here swimming, having their little barbecue.
That's Sue Ann Koster. Her grandson threw a pool party at her house while she and her husband were away. The grandson was in high school, and one of the teens who went over to swim came back and robbed her.
I was recuperating from breast cancer, and I had done a year of chemo, and my husband had said he wanted to take me for a little trip. Well, when I came back, I was not only a victim of cancer, but I was a victim of a burglary.
The teen stole jewelry, including her husband's wedding band and a necklace Koster got as an anniversary gift. Koster won $2,600 restitution for the stolen jewelry, but there was also another $6,000 for things like mileage, lost wages, and the cost of new security upgrades to her home, including spaying and neutering her new watchdogs, Dorothy and Toto. The offender still owes Koster about $1,000 in interest, but has otherwise paid the restitution in full, which is rare. There are no statewide statistics on juvenile restitution, but Youth Radio collected numbers from three of California's largest counties and found that less than 30% of restitution amounts are satisfied.
I think people recognize there are certain dollar amounts that are just not going to be paid at all, ever.
Roger Chan runs the East Bay Children's Law Offices in Oakland. Juvenile law, says Chan, is about reform, giving young people a chance to start over. But he argues restitution too often gets in the way because it saddles kids with unreasonably high debt. He's trying to change California's law to let judges consider a kid's ability to pay.
If you order such a huge amount of restitution to a young person who has no ability to pay it, how meaningful is that as a consequence? Is that really an effective way for the young person to be rehabilitated? Is that also something that's really beneficial to victims?
To say that juvenile restitution is complicated is an understatement. It's a process that wrestles with two competing philosophies around the idea of justice. Justice for victims who have the right to be paid for their losses, even when the offender spends time in jail. And justice for juvenile offenders who need to be held accountable, but also allowed to move on from their crimes and from the system. In Oakland, I'm Sarah Quevedo for Marketplace.
Double Charged is an investigation into the American juvenile justice system produced by Youth Radio. You can see the people from Sayer's story, plus more from the entire series, handy graphs, information, the whole deal. It's all online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by RingCentral, cloud business phone systems designed to meet the needs of today's mobile and distributed workforces. Learn more at ringcentral.com. By Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions to help organizations of all types and sizes achieve their strategic goals. More at kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by Wix.com, giving millions of business owners the ability to create their own professional website. You can create a website today online at Wix.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the preface that NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell had a press conference today in which he said again that he is sorry he handled the Ray Rice incident the way he did, that the NFL will do all it can to assist groups that fight domestic violence, and that no, he has not thought about resigning at all. On a day, though, when Apple fans lined up by the thousands to get their iPhone 6s, so too did Ravens fans line up at M&T Bank Stadium in Baltimore by the thousands.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.